We continue our conversation on education for Dig Deep with our conservative Chuck Marone and liberal Aaron Brown. Where we left it at was with Aaron explaining the kind of a Scandinavian Swedish model of retraining workers, an entire company is how you were describing it.
Yeah, and I can to become be a little more specific even. It was a Swedish lumber company in Pitya, Sweden, on the eastern shore of the country in the north. And they had a lumber company, family-owned many generations, and they made boards and trusses like lumber companies do. And like everywhere, like we've experienced right here in northern Minnesota, simple lumber bottomed out in terms of the market for it a couple different times. And a lot of lumber companies and loggers, independent loggers, have felt all this over the years, have felt the blowback from that. Well, this family company, which could have closed its doors, could have, you know, sold out, instead worked with their regional municipality, their regional, they have like, they're like a county basically, they're like our state or something, but their regional government worked with them to retrain their workforce to, instead of making trusses and boards, to make entire modular parts of buildings, modular homes, but especially apartment buildings, larger buildings, which then, because they're on the ocean, they can ship it down to Stockholm and their marketplace with low costs, you know. So they're shipping parts of apartment buildings, which can then be assembled in urban environments very successfully. And they doubled in size. They're rather than closing, they're twice as big as they used to be. And the owner was talking to me about the pivotal role that essentially their local community college played in making that happen. And it was, you know, a state runs college. It's a, you know, it's like a state, like our version of my employer, Hibbing Community College, worked with them to customize a training program to get this whole workforce retrained without them being laid off. That's the example I was using just for clarity.
Here's what I find interesting about the European model. And actually, having spent time in Italy and getting kind of a firsthand look at this from an educator standpoint, but then also seeing it in other places, I initially rejected it as this is ridiculous. Like, I don't like this at all. And here's what I didn't like. At a relatively young age, there is, in a sense, like a discernment process. And I'm going to go back to where we were in the first segment. Are you on a wisdom track or are you on a technical track? And you're talking about people who in our culture would be sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, and look at someone and say, you know what, you're kind of this kind of person here. I think you're going to be more like a welder or more like a carpenter. And you over here, you seem more like a philosopher or like a history professor. And so we're going to nudge you in a sense in that direction. Now, coming from, my parents were teachers. And there's a certain, I think my dad could have told you, like, these kids will wind up in jail and these kids are going to go on and do something, because you just have that sense of like, this kid's a shyster. But I can tell you that I had teachers that I'm positive would have put me in the, you should be a welder kind of camp, right? Mm-hmm. Like very early on, you know, this there's no hope for this kid. Let's get him in some kind of thing where we can focus him a little bit. I rejected that as just not consistent with American culture. I don't know if you have a thought about...
Well, I'm glad I waited to let you finish, because I was going to say, my dad and anybody who grew up in the 60s and 70s, who were high school, you know, seniors in, like, let's say the 70s, would tell you about the various educational experiments that were conducted on them in high schools all over the country. And a lot of them were localized attempts to do what you just described, create the two-track system, and whether you want to just make it as simple as, you know, ditch diggers and scholars. But certainly the shop kids and the college kids would be an accurate way that it was perceived as at the time.
Right.
My dad actually went to a couple schools. He moved around a lot, so he never fully finished his experimentation. But he would talk about this, and he was a shop kid, and that was his track. So that's something that was tried, and I think it was fairly rejected.
I think it would be rejected.
Yeah, it did not take. I'll put it that way. It did not take in a widespread fashion. And I think because of the cultural notion that we talked about way back in the first segment of equality, and the notion that, well, everybody should have the ability to become, and this is what is American. This is America. You are the lowliest among us. You must live your life believing that you will end up the richest and most powerful human being in the country.
Right.
This is what we believe.
Well, let me add on to that too. Yeah. You must believe that, and here's $50,000 of debt for you to discern your path to that.
Potentially.
Whether you could get there or not.
But it goes much deeper though. That's why things like tax cuts for higher income groups end up, if not being, there might not be popular, but nobody's, if you look at the way that people vote, they don't get really upset about that. They get a little upset, but they don't get really upset about that. And part of that is because, honestly, if you talk to people who make less than $30,000 a year, who vote for tax cuts for people who make more than $250,000 a year, they'll say, well, I'm going to be in that tax bracket someday, you know, or they hold that belief. And so they earned it. They get it because someday I'm going to get it too, if I work hard enough and everything comes out my way. That, I think, if you go back to the 1920s and the movies of the early 1900s and the rags to riches stories that were so popular back then, that's baked into our culture. And so the notion that you could live and work with dignity in a manual labor job that changed with the times and the technology, but you would make a good living and be happy and be content in your family life and community life and achieve things in life that were not becoming the richest person in the country. We aren't built for that the way they are in Europe, where that kind of thing has a little more dignity, I think. And that's probably why their social democracies are more successful there. You know,
no, the industries that we have here that would want, the logging company that would want the retraining of its employees would want the employees to take out debt to do that and would want the government to pay the other part of it. Mm-hmm. And I look at that and I'm like, okay, that is, again, this kind of Americanism where we socialize the expenses and we privatize the gains.
We socialize the risk and we privatize the reward.
Right. And this is where I think the reaction has been, let's socialize more of this. Let's have more training. Let's have more education. And I'm actually gone to the other side now, where I think that the lumber company that needs a retool, I would like to see them have their own apprentice program, their own internal training program. I think that by creating this bubble of education where everybody out there, the guy working behind the counter at the Holiday mm-hmm. store has got a 2-year degree from a community college. I'm not begrudging that person. And I think that they're probably a better American, a better Minnesotan, a better human, having been exposed to some of the ideas they would get in a 2-year degree. I'm not against that. I would like them to get exposed to those ideas in less of a way that's going to burden them long-term and will give them more career options long-term than what they currently have.
Only the very biggest companies can truly have an internal customized training house.
Let me push back on that right away.
Okay.
Because I think that if you look historically at the way tradespeople worked, often it was one person with an apprentice or one person with a mm-hmm. shop, and they would have two people who are graduate apprentices and then like four people
working. But not with the changing technology we see. I'll push back again on this Scandinavian guy I talked to, the grandson of the founder, great grandson, I don't know what. And he was faced this situation where his company was failing or going to fail. He saw it coming. He saw the path. And he needed to adopt technology that at the time he was only loosely familiar with that he was learning himself. And he had to get not only himself, but all these workers trained for a particular kind of work up to speed. And when you look at what's changing in the workplace now and why employment is such a tricky, strange thing is the rapidly changing institutions and technology. And it does pay, and this is where I'll stick up for my profession in a big way. It does pay to have people who are following these trends, learning the new technology, and are able to, at the drop of a hat, literally, you know, if a company announces they need help or if something like that comes in, that there is a place where workers or people will have access to learning those things. And I know what you're talking about, because if I'm a blacksmith and I know how to work the stuff, you know,
right.
And I want to just take some kid from town and teach that person how to be a blacksmith, that is a remarkably efficient and sustainable way to handle it. So I don't want to dismiss that. But on the other hand, when you look at, you know, what if the technology was changing? What if the materials were changing? This is the challenge of our modern society, and it's always been a challenge. It's just, I think it's happening faster than it used to happen, and it's catching whole industries. Automation is catching whole industries out of position.
Now, let's look at our broader economy. Let's look at where like most people are working, and particularly most people who are struggling today are working. If you're going to make an argument, and I think it's a fair argument, that the person working the till at McDonald's is getting put out of work by automation, because now you can go to the board and order your food
or
yourself.
The automated checkouts at the retail stores. Yeah,
all this. You look at this broad sector of our workforce that's being displaced. What you're talking about is an economic model based on efficiency. And we have long argued here on this show, and I think come to a general agreement, that the economic model based on efficiency is not the optimum model for rural America. It's certainly not the optimum model for our region.
Yeah, because the most efficient way to run rural Minnesota is to have five people and a bunch of robots.
Yeah, well, and to have economic systems that basically extract wealth and capital from our area, mm-hmm. not build it and create it here.
Right.
So what I'm actually saying is that our education system right now today, from really middle school, high school, up to the junior college system and the technical college and the university system, is designed to, in the context of our local economy, create two types of people. The people who leave and take their wisdom and their cultural and just go away and don't come back. And if they do come back, they're only coming back in the form of capital to start a Wendy's or start a, you know, invest in Target or something like that, mm-hmm. that extracts wealth. And then the other kind is the kind we burden up and load up with debt so they can ultimately wind up, instead of being the apprentice at the restaurant, learning how to wait on tables or prepare food
or even to run a small business.
Or run a small business. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're now like the chef at Applebee's, following like the program training that is efficiently set out for them. And here's how we make a hamburger, the same at this Applebee's as every other Applebee's. By making our people cogs in this efficient system, we both explode the cost of education while simultaneously devaluing the work that people are actually doing. And this is my kind of argument for, in a sense, trying to opt out of this centralizing system. I feel like the education, and I'll use the word racket again, because it slides off my tongue. I feel like this education racket is really in bed with this notion of our path to prosperity is efficiency. Our path to prosperity here in the northeast of Minnesota is to play the game that they're playing in the Twin Cities and the suburbs. Just play a junkier version of that game, you know, like a cheap version of that game. We can do that up here and we can be successful doing it. And I think when we look around, what we see is that our income disparities are huge. The gap between our rich and poor is huge. The fact that if you don't get the college degree with $40,000 in debt and get the ante to get in the door, get your exclusive license so you can cut hair. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, the certificates you have to get to cut someone's hair and the costs involved in that.
But Chuck, have you ever had a really bad haircut?
I always have a bad haircut. You look at this and you say, what are we doing to our people? Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time defending. I look at my kids and my kids will go to college. I insist on it, right? There's not an option for them not to. I went to college. I benefited from this. I think it is rather convenient and you know, lazy and exclusive for me to look around and say the path to prosperity for 95% of the people listening to this right now is to follow the path I've been on. That's the way you do it. Because if we all did that, we would all be failures. Like, it wouldn't work. The society wouldn't work. We have to find a different path for people who we need to be successful. We need them to be prosperous.
I feel like you're making an institutional argument, which I can't even really say is all wrong, but that there is, what we're still talking about is education. Because that person has to know things and has to know how to think. And we've mostly been talking about higher education. We've been talking less about K-12 education or E-12 education. And I think and this is just speaking as a community college guy, we get every kind of person. What we find and what our entrance exams will show you from a quantitative standpoint is that high schools in certain subject matters, math particularly among them, but also writing, high schools are not, according to some objective standard, preparing students to do these things at a professional level or what we would call a college level. But if you don't want to call it college level and just say a professional level.
Let me take that to the next step, because the Star Tribune ran a couple of years ago a whole series about the dumbing down of grades, grade inflation at the college level. Mm-hmm. And if you make college a business.
Oh, you mean college or high school?
At the college level. When you make college a business, it is not in your best interest once you've accepted a student to fail them out. The ideal college student, and this is really sad, but in many ways, the ideal college student is the one who pays for 4 years of education and then doesn't get the degree. So the degree remains kind of exclusive for the alumni and the people who got it, but the college got all the money of having them there for 4 years.